From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. In this week's podcast, we hear from a publisher pleading with his industry, please stop giving away good writing for free.
We are going to be out of business, and it's going to be catastrophic for American culture.
And a young actress faces a tough choice.
It was kind of acting or gymnastics. It was a hard choice, but I chose acting.
We think she made the right decision. Then J.J. Abrams, first Star Trek, now Star Wars. He knows what you're thinking.
It's too much power for one man.
All that plus some very good reasons not to hate the Goldberg variations. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Coming up, the chilling effect of NSA surveillance, stories that never get written. But first...
When you read Time each week, you know more. You understand.
It wasn't that long ago that bookstores were everywhere you could find shops. And in front, the mighty magazine stand.
Pick up this week's People.
Games. A magazine.
The new family circle is weird.
Welcome to Psychology
this
Today.
This week's Woman's Day.
Reach for a Star.
TV Guide.
Do you know there's a magazine devoted entirely to cats?
But you know the story. The internet came, and everything changed. Bookstores folded. The vast majority of magazines put their content up online because the conventional wisdom at the time said that you had to plant your flag on the web, build it, and they will come. And they did come, in huge numbers. The problem was they didn't pay anything. That may be changing, and that's our cover story today. Who pays for your content? John R. MacArthur is the president and publisher of Harper's, a magazine that's been around since 1850. And since the beginning of the internet age, Harper's has protected its writing behind a paywall, despite MacArthur's many colleagues considering him a bit of a dinosaur. In a publisher's letter last month in Harper's, MacArthur lambasted the industry for trashing what he calls the compact between writer and reader.
My quarrel is with the publishers and the advertising agencies who have turned writing into what they unfortunately refer to as content. And there's been a systematic degradation of the craft of writing, not just of payment for writing. And I am trying to restore a certain amount of respect for writers and writing.
Why did everyone just start putting up content, sorry to use that word, for free?
Well, the publishers, most of whom are ex-ad salesmen or currently ad salesmen, are mainly interested in what they call total audience and cost per thousand. And they imagined that since the web reached potentially billions of English reading consumers, their audience was, in theory, almost infinite. And the cost per thousand for reaching those people, if they gave away the information or gave away the articles, would drop to levels that would excite ad agencies. And of course, the opposite has occurred. The ad agencies got excited about social media and about Google, which they think, at least at this point, are much more efficient ways to advertise.
Why at the time didn't Harper's jump on that free content bandwagon?
I realized when I first got into this that if you didn't have committed readers willing to pay for writing, you didn't really have much of a future. You didn't have really much of a magazine. That made a better subscriber for advertisers, and it made a better reader for writers, in my opinion. So I said to the young people on my staff who were clamoring for free, let's be like everybody else, I said, forget it. I said, if we can't convince our readers that we're producing something of value that they should pay for, we're finished.
If the readers are getting to the material, though, you know, whether it's through a digital portal or behind a paywall or not, what does it matter?
Well, they won't get to the material will stop being produced. If nobody can make a living writing, which is where we're getting, writing or writers as we know them are going to disappear. I cite one example in Harper's. We published a series of photographs from Iran that were taken by an anonymous photographer who risked their liberty and cost us a lot of money, I think all told $25,000, to send them to Iran to take pictures that the government doesn't want us to see. Now, why shouldn't that person be compensated for what they did, for the risk they take? Why shouldn't we be compensated for it? Why should it be free? And Google, they just want to aggregate it, as they say, and relay it across their network and then sell advertising adjacent to it. They don't want to compensate the photographer or us. So we take all the risk. We do all the work. And we don't get any of the benefit. That's not a healthy equation. And it's going to wind up deeply, deeply. It's already damaged American democracy, in my opinion.
Is Harper's making money?
Well, we don't know how this year is going to turn out. Last year we lost a little, but I'm cautiously optimistic. Now, that being said, it's a crisis right now. The odds against us are heavy when you take into consideration the immense propaganda now that has been pushed forward on the free content model. And unless people come to their senses, and I see them coming to their senses now at the New York Times, and they never lost their senses at the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal. Unless people come to their senses and realize that the advertising is not coming back and we have to charge the subscribers more or the newsstand buyers more, we are going to be out of business, and it's going to be catastrophic for American culture.
John R. MacArthur, president and publisher of Harper's Magazine. Now, Harper's has it easier than most. They've got 160 years of heritage to attract paying customers. The other companies that make paywalls work, like the Wall Street Journal or Financial Times, also tend to have established reputations and existing readers. Uzumaka Maduka does not. She and her partner started The American Reader just 1 year ago. Didn't people say, what are you thinking trying to launch a magazine right now?
Yeah, yes, and they especially said, what are you thinking trying to launch a print magazine right now?
The American Reader is a monthly publication of new fiction, poetry, and criticism. For Maduka, setting up a paywall just isn't feasible.
Because we're just starting out, we are more inclined to give more of our writing basically away for free because we want people to get to know what we're doing. But certainly I think for those people who've been around longer, I do agree with Mr. MacArthur. I think it is a very disastrous road to go down.
Maduka is in her mid-20s. She's right in the middle of the millennial generation that publishers think have abandoned the printed page. Well, think again.
You know, it's been my experience that our generation, when it comes to technology, we're ambidextrous. We'd like to have choices between print or digital. And I don't think it really profits anyone to be led by the nose by that sort of hysterical reaction.
What's the kind of hysteria? Like, what's the kind of sky is falling things that you're hearing?
Well, the idea that print is dead, that, you know, no one is going to be reading in that form anymore, that because people have short, diminished attention spans, first of all, the fact that that would be the case. Secondly, that this would mean that all the content, as people call it, would have to be shorter or more accessible, accessible being a buzzword for dumbing things down. We felt that the opposite was the case. Among our generation, we felt people were hungry for more sophisticated writing, for deeper engagement with the topics of the day. These are things that people have been shying away from in the past 10 years because of the bad advice that they have been getting, because of the sort of histrionic attitudes that are going on throughout the industry. And the readers have really suffered. And I think it's up to discerning editors right now to bring us back to where we need to be.
Uzumaka Maduka says The American Reader has just over 1,100 paid subscribers for the print edition of the magazine. That might have marked a failure 20 years ago. But today, with cheaper printing runs and fewer middlemen, smaller print runs are feasible. So what does the future hold? Can your local paper, for instance, start protecting its reporting behind a paywall as well? According to Trish Haygood of the database Media Finder, that won't work.
Well, because news is ubiquitous. For something to be special, I mean, the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times make money. The data has to be proprietary or essential. If you have a unique product, then you can maintain a paywall. If you have a product that anybody can get anywhere, like the news, you're in trouble.
Haygood says fewer magazines started up this year, but fewer folded as well. In the meantime, more paywalls are going up. On Thursday, authorities in Canada announced they had busted an enormous international child pornography operation. It was the end of a 3-year investigation into a website that trafficked in illicit videos of young boys. 348 people have been arrested in connection with the videos, 76 of them in the U.S. Investigations like this end with press conferences and high-profile trials, but they begin far away from the public eye with one of the most difficult jobs in the world. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports, but first a warning, this story contains content that some listeners may find disturbing.
Rich Brown knows how to crack a child pornography case. For decades, he was a cop for the New Jersey State Police. He worked on the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, and part of his job was to look through suspects' hard drives, image by image, which meant he saw some terrible, terrible things.
You know, I think there's certain things that are more difficult. I do remember seeing the first molestation video. It was a husband that was molesting his two daughters.
When he went home at night, it was difficult for Brown to forget what he had seen.
I have two boys, and I remember being ultra protective of my boys during the time that I was involved with this type of work, and I think that's pretty common.
Brown says this kind of work can be traumatic. Some officers had trouble sleeping or marriage problems. But cops are no longer the only people getting paid to review images of child pornography. The rise of internet porn has created a shadow industry of people working for tech companies like Google, Microsoft, and Facebook. They spend 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, looking at pictures and videos and asking themselves, is this child pornography?
This is a shadow industry by design. So you're not going to find an association of commercial content moderators publishing statistics and necessarily making themselves known in that way. There's value to the invisibility.
That's Sarah Roberts of Western University. She's one of the few people who systematically studies those who do this work. She says even though the internet couldn't function without content moderators, very few have heard of them, even within the tech industry.
A lot of them are under non-disclosure agreements, so they're precluded from speaking to the media, and it is difficult to reach out and find them. And I think there's an aspect of trauma that can often go along with this work, and many workers would rather go home and tune out and not talk about it. So I think the unknown aspect of this work is certainly by design. It's no mistake that it's difficult to find workers who will talk to you about this.
Microsoft and Google both declined to put me in touch with any of the people who review images for their services. Samantha Durr is the director of child protection at Microsoft.
It's a yucky job. In fact, Microsoft has to invest in, you know, wellness programs for people that work on this.
In March, Microsoft and eight other tech companies came out with guidelines for such wellness programs. They suggest employees take their minds off traumatic content by, for example, taking a 15-minute walk or engaging in a hobby. Many companies have a counseling hotline for employees. But Sarah Roberts says that may not be enough.
We're also talking about a culture in which your success at your job is directly tied to your ability to stomach this imagery. So if someone were to access these kinds of support services, there may be an implicit suggestion that they're not cut out for the work that they're trying to do for a living.
Durr says internet service providers are investing in ways to decrease the number of people who need to do this kind of work, and with good reason.
Unlike any other kind of, you know, offensive or illegal content online, the image itself is a crime scene, and every new viewing of that image is a revictimization of that child.
Scott Rubin is a spokesman for Google.
When we become aware of one of those images, we will create this digital signature. It's like a fingerprint. It's a series of ones and zeros unique to that particular image.
In an effort to automate the process, Microsoft and Google have both created such software. Tagged pictures are sent to a database at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which coordinates with law enforcement. And earlier this year, Twitter also began using the Microsoft program to screen every photo posted to that site. But despite the software advances, the need for content moderators is still growing, and Sarah Roberts says that workers she's spoken to often feel stigmatized.
They've said things to me like, you don't want an internet without our interventions. But at the same time, it's exacting a toll on these workers. And because this industry is so new and the need for this work is so new, I think the jury is out as to what the real implications are going to be for these people later on in their life.
And as demand grows, companies are looking to cheap foreign workers to do some of the most difficult work. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Mismatched partners are a staple of cop dramas and comedies alike. In the new Fox TV show, Almost Human, mismatched partners are required by law. The year is 2048, and every police officer is required to work with an android partner. Carl Urban, you might remember him as Dr. McCoy in the new Star Trek movies, plays a human cop with a bionic leg who has issues with the new protocol.
I'm not driving with one of those things. A human partner was good enough for my father. It's good enough for me.
He does end up with a robo-partner anyway. Michael Ealy plays the android, who had been shut down for having some issues of his own.
I was decommissioned 4 years ago, as you know. All of us were. Why am I in this car with you?
I'm required to ride with the synthetic.
I'm not a huge fan of that term.
J.J. Abrams, the man behind hit TV shows like Felicity, Alias, and Lost, is the executive producer of Almost Human. He says the name of his new series is more ambiguous than you might think.
The title Almost Human applies to both of the main characters, and these are two characters that are sort of broken. They're kind of both in various ways on the scrap heap, and they both kind of save each other.
You know, in science fiction, there have been a lot of soulless characters that I think help us explore our humanity, whether it's a Vulcan or an android. This android has a bit more soul to him than your typical android.
I think you're right. As a kid, I used to love The $6 Million Man. And I love the idea of sort of technology and humanity overlapping. What I loved about this idea that Joel Wyman pitched was that this partner, this synthetic partner, was in many ways the partner you would want in a cop car with you, that he is the guy who was not only brave and incredibly fit and had all the information you wanted instantly, but is also someone who is actually compassionate and insightful and thoughtful and someone who would really be in many ways more human than the human partner he had.
Do you have your own idea of at what point we cease to become human when we integrate too much with technology?
There is this assumption that we all have that we are in control of who we are and that these machines sort of work for us and do our jobs, you know, that we tell them to do. But I remember a time, and this is many years ago already, I came home one day and my fax machine had a light blinking and it said press start, so I pressed start, and then it said replace paper, so I replaced the paper. And I realized that for about 10 minutes I was doing every single thing that this computer, this machine was asking me to do. And I think that there are moments when we become slaves to the machine. And the question of technology, it's the interface, the handshake that we make with these machines that we are carrying in our pockets every day and interacting with all the time, I think is sometimes more nuanced and a little bit more insidiously unbalanced than we think.
I found myself saying please and thank you to Siri sometimes.
You know, it's funny. I do that too, and I know I'm being absolutely insane as I do it, but I do the same exact thing.
I want to talk about your new book. I think I need to describe it as an object. It's called S, and you get this book called The Ship of Theseus. It's a fake book written by a fake author, but it's also filled with all this marginalia written by people who have owned the book. So it's like a book with multiple levels and multiple stories.
Yeah, it is as odd as you describe it. The idea came from a very simple place, which is that I was at Los Angeles Airport about 15 years ago or so, and I saw a paperback book that I picked up. It was sitting on a bench, and I opened it up, and someone had written inside, to whomever finds this book, please read the book, take it somewhere else, and leave it for someone else to find it. I still have this book. I've never read it, frankly, and I've never left it for anyone else. It began a kind of thought process for me, which was, what if someone found a book that had extensive notes written in it and responded to some of those notes and then left the book back? And what if that person who left the book originally found the book? And what if a conversation began strictly through the margins of a novel? A wonderful author named Doug Dorst heard this pitch and his eyes lit up. And I thought, oh my God, he's crazy too. And we literally thought that no one would really get it or be interested. And we found out yesterday it's on the New York Times bestseller list and we can't believe it.
I would think it would be incredibly hard to make these things because the book is filled with, you pick it up and things fall out of it like a napkin with a mysterious map scrawled on it. And it's an actual napkin, you know.
All I wanted was for the book to look like a real library book from the late 40s, early 50s. And I wanted it to look like people had actually written in the margins in pen.
It's kind of an interesting shift. You know, from working with such high levels of technology in the film and television media to this thing that's very kind of old-fashioned. And, you know, again, it's this physical object that you have to experience in a very traditional way.
Well, the idea for this was that these two people meet through a book. It's almost like a play on top of a novel. And therefore, the form that would best represent that idea was a book. Just as some ideas are a better song than a movie or a better play, you know, than a painting. It's like, you know, every idea sort of demands its own form. And it just felt like that's what this was. This is not meant to be a movie, but we're going to release it first as a book. This is really the format it was meant to be, I think.
Do you think there's anything else like this you might produce?
You know, the idea of doing something in theater is very interesting to me. I've always wanted to do a children's book. You know, there are things like that. Who knows if, you know, I'll ever find the time.
Are you able to talk at all about the new Star Wars film?
I mean, it's too early to say anything specific, but I will say that we're hard at work on it, and it could not be more of a thrill to be involved.
You know, I have to say, for a lot of science fiction geeks like myself, before anybody complains, that when you took over the Star Wars franchise, our heads almost exploded. It's almost like that was too much power for one man. How do you feel about that?
I agree. It's too much power for one man. The truth is that the Star Wars series is something that had such meaning for me as a kid. When they approached me about it, I was insanely flattered, but felt like it was too much. Having done, frankly, you know, Mission Impossible and Star Trek, I was already involved in a couple series that pre-existed me, and I wanted to get back to doing original stories. It was such a once-in-a-lifetime chance to do something truly thrilling and wildly challenging, and it just felt like...
Right. How do you turn that down?
Yeah.
J.J. Abrams is the executive producer of the new show, Almost Human. It premieres tonight on Fox and will regularly be on Monday nights. He's also the co-author of the new book, S. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Once again, you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. It's not easy to make a living as a jazz musician. Saxophonist Ted Nash makes it work, but he probably makes it harder on himself by also being a composer who's recently developed a taste for writing large-scale works. So when he was offered a commission for a big piece, he was thrilled. Great, he said.
He says, but it has to be a specific theme of the seven chakras.
And you had no idea what he was talking about?
I mean, I had a basic idea about it, but really, when it comes down to it, I knew very little about the seven chakras and began my research.
Ted Nash is not a Hindu. Even if you are a Hindu, you might not be up on the details of the chakras. In yoga philosophy, there are seven energy centers in the body. They start at the base of the spine and work their way up. And that first chakra represents your more base, lower emotions.
Then at a certain point, I realized I wanted to experience it in a different way. So I went to a chakra specialist and had some work done to sort of feel the effects of being worked on my chakras.
And what did they do? What does a chakra specialist do?
Well, they have different techniques. This one used her voice, and she sang in a really kind of a shrill voice, but it was just got deep inside of me. Her name is Jodi Sirota, and that's what she does. She's a chakra healer. She said, is there a particular chakra that you are concerned about? And I said, well, to be honest, I think my fifth chakra, which is the communication chakra, is one that I need some help with, because I was about ready to do something that required me to be very succinct and very articulate, and I didn't feel I was ready for that. And so she worked on my fifth chakra, and then when I showed up in the situation, I was extremely articulate, and I got to the points, and I got to things that I wanted to be very clear about. So it was a great experience.
And then so you built the compositions kind of on that, one for each chakra, starting from the bottom?
Exactly. I started from the beginning. Now, you've got the root chakra, which is also known as Muladhara, and it's the most basic. It's the foundation. It's our most unconscious, really, and primitive self. And so, you know, I created an ostinato bass line. It's a very, like, the foundation. It's like an infant looking out into the world for the first time. So I made the piece very simple, and it grows as if the infant was starting to learn about life. You mentioned that bass line. I kind of feel that throughout this album, there's a pulse to any music, but this feels especially organic. There's almost like a heartbeat going through this. Yeah, I feel very important relationship to the rhythm section for this project. And there's even the heart chakra, and that piece is called Air. It represents our ability to love. You know, it's devotion and self-confidence. They're very important forces as we strive to, you know, achieve a balance. So I do use the feeling of the heart. There's like a heartbeat at the beginning of this movement. What are the kind of sounds and textures you can get with a big band that you couldn't with a more standard-sized jazz ensemble? Well, you know, first of all, with a big band, you can really explore chords. You can make the chords much bigger than you can with, say, a smaller group. With a brass section, you've got a variety of mutes that changes the color of the sounds. You've got harmon mutes and plunger mutes. The plunger mute makes it sound like a human voice. If you can remember in the Charlie Brown thing, when he's talking to his parents, it's always a trombone. Wah, 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 wah. So it's like that human voice sound. So when I did number 5, which is this, the throat chakra, I had Alfonso Horn use the plunger mute to get that sort of vocal sound. So that was one way I was able to use the colors of the instruments and variety of colors of the instruments to get a particular sound.
I'm talking with Ted Nash. His new album is called Chakra. In terms of leading an ensemble, how is it different being a conductor from being a band leader?
I love standing in front of the big band. And I don't do it as much as I want, but there's something about looking around, having all these great musicians bringing to life your music, and then being able to shape it. You stand in front of the band, you can look around, you can help the dynamics. If you're feeling something spontaneously, you can make it happen with your hands, with certain indications, and I love that. I love sort of shaping the band. It's almost like being a sculptor as much as you are a conductor.
I want you to talk about the last tune on this album. It's called Cosmos. It feels like it covers a lot of musical and spiritual territory in 7 minutes.
It's funny because when I wrote this piece of music, I wrote the first 6 movements and then I stopped. And I waited 3 or 4 years before getting to number 7, which is sort of the highest, most spiritually evolved of the chakras. And I waited because I wasn't ready to perform the music or record it, and I wanted to be myself as spiritually evolved as possible before doing it. I sat with it for a while, and suddenly I came up with this melody. And when I was writing the melody, I was sitting at the piano. And when I finished playing the melody, I actually cried. I had tears in my eyes, and I realized, okay, I'm touching on something that is very real for me. And then I began to capture that as much as possible.
Ted Nash's new album, Chakra, is a big band project. He spoke with me from New York. Ted, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here, as always.
There's a land rush going on right now. At least that's how everyone seems to be describing the opening up of vast amounts of internet real estate. Pretty soon there's going to be a lot more than .coms out there.
Moveover.com and .net. Soon we may be serving .google and .lol.
Put out a list of potential new domain names. Getting one of them is neither easy nor cheap.
A lot of big companies and a few upstarts are bidding huge amounts to get the new internet addresses. That's our cover story today. The domain name land rush. Who is selling? Who is buying? And are you missing out? I registered my first internet domain name last year. I don't have big ambitions, but I figured that with a billion Indians, it was only a matter of time before someone snatched up arunroth.com. To do this, you go through a commercial domain retailer, like GoDaddy or domainnames.com. But who owns the address you're buying? Well, that's never totally clear. You may think that you're buying it from the government, that the sale of these new domain names is like selling parts of the radio spectrum for TV or radio broadcasts. And it would make sense to think that. The U.S. government did create the internet in the 1980s, but in a move with staggering implications, we gave it up to the world. Brad White is a spokesman for the organization that sprung up to administer the sale and designation of domain names. It's called ICANN, and it's the only governing body that does this in the entire world.
It would have been very easy for the U.S. government to have said, you know what? We invented the internet, so therefore we're going to control this addressing system. Instead, came up with this system, and they said, let's create this nonprofit public benefit organization. Everybody will have input, and we'll create this sort of bottom-up system of policymaking.
Charles Severance teaches information technology at the University of Michigan and has followed this movement since the beginning.
In the very earliest of days, when the two-letter country codes were created, they basically said, we're going to create .ly, and we're going to delegate everything to the left of .ly to be managed by the Libyan government, whoever it presents themselves as the designated official representative of the Libyan government is allowed to manage the namespace from there on.
If they want, the country or territory can just sell that space, and many have. If you tweet an NPR story, you might notice the URL starts n.pr, then some characters. That PR originally belonged to Puerto Rico. TV stations and lots of other companies buy these links because we need short URLs. They're easier to deal with and way easier to fit into a tweet. That's why domains can be so valuable and why so many people are excited about the new domains. The problem with the land rush analogy, though, is that this isn't land, or anything even like land. Land is a physical thing. So one of Tony Soprano's favorite axioms about investing, buy land because the good Lord isn't making any more, doesn't apply to the internet. ICANN can simply make more virtual real estate, which is exactly what they did. So what is this virtual land worth? And are you missing out on a great opportunity? Well, only if you've got a few million dollars to spare and are willing to take a bit of a risk. Jeff Sass is the marketing director for the newly minted .club. He can say that now because his company successfully bid on the .club domain.
The fee alone was $185,000. And then, of course, there's legal costs and financial, you know, papers and other things that have to be done as part of it.
After paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for the application and legal fees, they had to bid for .club in a private auction. Every day they had to log on and see if the other companies bidding for .club were still in the running. It was nerve-wracking.
And this went on for several days until finally we were victorious.
And can I ask how much you ended up spending?
You can certainly ask, but I won't be able to tell you exactly. What I can say is that, you know, .club domains has raised $8.2 million to date. So that's what we raised for our company. And that money was to apply for, obtain the name, market the name, et cetera. And we've certainly spent in excess of $5 million to date on the whole process.
And the losers in the bid process, they're just out that application fee and everything else?
Well, actually, that's really interesting because in this case, the way the private auction was structured, the winner, in our case, .club, pays the winning price, and actually the proceeds of the auction are split between the other contenders. So in our case, the whatever amount that we paid for the domain name, less the cost of the auction, was actually split between the two parties who lost the auction. So one could argue that they both won and lost at the same time.
Did you catch that? The losers of the auction were paid by the winner. Now, if you're thinking that sounds like a screwy way to sell something, you're not the only one. We talked to David Mitnick, an intellectual property lawyer who specializes in domain law. He explained the money that losers make off auctions often finds its way back into the bidding market.
Some companies have done quite well. There's a company called Donuts that is has applied for over 200 registries. They're what we call a portfolio player, and they're making a substantial investment into a number of different registries and hope to own basically a large slice of the internet. And they have made quite a bit of money actually losing auctions. And the money that they've been able to get from losing those auctions, I imagine, is being siphoned back into their operations and actually to bid for properties that they may think are more valuable than the ones that they lost.
So is it worth it? Is shelling out this kind of money for the perfect name a good strategy? Well, in cyberspace, property value is what you make of it. Again, Professor Severance.
Will.soda for soda pop vendors. Will that be valuable? Well, I think it'll be more about how they make it valuable rather than just getting it.
There are people that are putting in a fair amount of money with the idea that there is going to be a big payoff in owning one of these domains. What's the thinking behind that?
I've been here since the beginning, and I had a friend who registered internet.com in 1992 and sold it for $250,000. But that is the only person that I know that made any money by speculating on domain names. And so that's the thing about sort of cyber squatting. Maybe you got lucky and you bought internet.com at the exact right time and you were the first person in, and yeah, you get paid off. But in general, just holding on to a 4 or 6 character string, unless you've made it valuable, you have to invest in making it valuable.
In other words, this may not be the kind of land rush that opens up opportunity for everybody. In fact, Brad White of ICANN doesn't think you should think of it as a land rush at all.
Land rush sort of, in my mind, infers this everybody running in at the moment and seizing property in the hopes of getting rich overnight. I don't know that that's necessarily what is happening here.
You talk about this expansion of territory, but throughout history, when someone's territory is expanded, someone else tends to lose. Are there losers here?
Well, I think in almost anything in life, there's winners and losers. But I don't know that I would necessarily structure it in that sort of oversimplified sense in this particular case. Cyberspace, the addressing system, is pretty big and pretty open, and there's room for a lot of expansion. One of the reasons that we launched into this program is because there was some concern that some of the most popular top-level domains, take .com, for example, some of the prime names were hard to get that people wanted.
There have been cases of businesses changing their name so they can have a website that matches. By some accounts, internet real estate is tight. But this doesn't mean there won't be losers as the new frontier opens up. David Mitnick is an intellectual property lawyer who advises companies buying and selling domain names. He says there are potential losers in this game. The biggest one is a company called VeriSign. Every .com site out there was sold by VeriSign.
I think 80-something percent of all domains right now exist in the .com space, of about 280 million. And the .com registry operator, VeriSign, was not thrilled about this idea that there was going to be more competition. There were only 22 top-level domains that existed before this program was started. Now there could potentially be an infinite number.
However, there is one change in the new internet address system that is certain to have a huge impact. Imagine that whenever you went online to do a search, buy shoes, whatever, you had to type the web address in Arabic or Mandarin or Tamil. Well, that's what the rest of the non-English-speaking world has to go through when they go online.
When you start thinking about doing things that are appropriate for consumers, publishing URLs in Korea, why is it that you can see something all in Korean and all of a sudden there's this URL and it has to use a Latin character set? And that's jarring. And, you know, 6- and 7-year-old children looking at educational resources won't have to learn a foreign language just to find their way to educational resources is the kind of positive benefit that's not really a speculation. And we're not making a bunch of money here, but we are changing what's possible to be done.
And in some ways, that's the most exciting part of this new frontier. Sophie Nolise is only 13 years old, but she's already faced big career decisions. She started training to be a gymnast at the age of 3 and has long had her eyes set on representing her native Canada at the 2016 Olympics. Then she had the opportunity of a lifetime, another opportunity of a lifetime, the lead in the film version of the beloved novel, The Book Thief.
My name is Lisa Memminger. I don't have a family or even a place to call home. I never understood the meaning of the word hope, but I'm about to meet the people who would change all that.
Liesl is taken in by a couple in Nazi Germany. Through the Holocaust and the war, as hatred and death loom around her, her passion for words helps her persevere. Sophie Nolise had very little acting experience and no formal training, so landing the role was a shock.
When I went to audition, I had no idea I was going to even get a call back. I was just really going for fun. So when I got the part, I screamed and I jumped into my brother's arms. I was really happy. And it was just a mixture of emotions because I was happy. I really wanted to start shooting, but then I was a bit stressed. I was a bit sad to leave my family for 4 months. I had a lot of schoolwork to catch up on.
And the other thing that I know about is that you're very serious about gymnastics at basically the Olympic level, which means practicing for that is pretty much a full-time job, right?
Mm-hmm. If you want to train at a kind of national and international level, you have about a week of break per year. Mm-hmm. So I was training about 6 hours per day. And I mean, obviously, if I missed 4 months, I could never go to the Olympics. Mm. So it was kind of acting or gymnastics. It was a hard choice, but I chose acting. But I still love gymnastics. I follow my friends. Sometimes I go and see them training. I still really into it.
Are there aspects of that find their way into your acting? You know, how you use your body or you know, how you move?
I think it is. It helped in many different ways. For example, I mean, if you're doing a beam routine and then you're in the middle of your backflip and then there's like 6-year-old girl that runs through the beam. If you lose concentration, you can fall and, you know, injure yourself. Hmm. You have to know your body really well. So I think when you're acting, you know, I know where the camera is. I'm aware of what's happening around me, or I know exactly where my mark is, so I don't have to, like, look down.
Interesting. So in the film, you play Liesl, a German girl who is orphaned. You have this beautiful on-screen relationship with Jeffrey Rush, who plays your adoptive father.
Let's make this our secret. We'll read it like the other book. The basement.
Thank you, Papa.
It feels like there's a real father-daughter love there on screen. What was it like working with him?
I actually didn't know who he was when I started to work with him. Huh. I've just heard that apparently he's a great actor. So I was completely honored to play with him, as well as Emily Watson. And he was just really like my father, just always there for me. And I never feel like I'm going in to work. I'd feel like I'm going to watch a clown all day. You know, he's going to be doing a random stunts, random things. And then when they say action, he'll do the scene perfectly. And when they say cut, he'll do a magic trick.
You know, your character in the film lives through some, you know, the most awful events of the 20th century. I'm wondering what it was like for you both being relatively young and not having done so much acting to act in a film about the Holocaust.
When I saw that I was on the Holocaust, it was something that really interested me because I didn't know a lot about that. So I knew that I had to do some research. So I watched a lot of movies. I watched Schindler's List, The Reader, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, Life is Beautiful, and The Pianist. And just walking through Berlin is really interesting because there's like always walls and posters telling you stories about history, and seeing the Berlin Wall or some bomb shelters is really interesting, and you can learn so much just walking through the city.
But you didn't know much about the Holocaust before working on this project?
No, because I think we only start learning about that in school, I think about next year. I'm in eighth grade, so I'd say ninth grade maybe.
Given that the film did deal with an awful lot of disturbing events, were there any scenes that were difficult for you, you know, especially as a new actor to have to wrestle with?
I think it was the hardest scenes were like the ones when I had to cry. And at the end of the day, that's I think the hardest scenes are the one that you're the most proud of.
Your character in the film has a real passion for reading that transforms her life. How do you feel about reading?
I love reading, just not really on an iPad or not on something else. I love the books, just being able to turn the pages. And I love to read because you kind of escape reality and you have a liberty that you don't necessarily have kind of on Earth. Hmm.
Sophie Nolise is the star of The Book Thief, which is in theaters now. Sophie, pleasure speaking with you. Best of luck.
Thank you so much. It was nice meeting you.
It's time for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Hey, Arun, always good to be with you.
So a fun piece this week about a service that could be the next big thing in food delivery.
Gotta love it. Once again, the Bay Area has given you special things, and this time not in technology, but in food delivery. And a couple of young guys who were UC Berkeley grads, food obsessed, were finding that they couldn't get their favorite foods delivered. So they started a new service called Caviar that for a flat fee is creating quite the Uber-like stir around San Francisco and now a little bit around Seattle and New York. They've got a lot of your basics, whether they're fish tacos or pulled pork sandwiches, but they also have some of the higher-end restaurants who in the past have been a little bit hesitant about doing delivery who now have agreed to do it.
And I guess like the Uber car service app, it's just a very streamlined experience.
Correct. So $9.99, so it's kind of a flat fee, which, you know, that kind of varies sometimes. They also don't have the kind of neighborhood restrictions. Arun, you probably have called to order from places sometimes, and they've asked where you are, and they've said you're kind of outside of our zone. Well, that was one of the things I think these young guys were trying to tackle.
We do a lot of eating at our desks around here, so hopefully they'll get to L.A. soon.
Sooner rather than later.
Another piece you have, there's a shirtless master in Sports Illustrated, which is not too unusual, except for the fact that this is a chess master, a 22-year-old chess master. Tell us about this guy.
Chess is not always the sexiest sport, but the number one chess player in the world is a young guy from Norway named Magnus Carlsen, who's becoming quite the sensation. He is not only a champion chess player, but he's also a male model. And that's a very different look from, say, Bobby Fischer or Garry Kasparov, who were two other famous chess champions of the past. And as we speak, Carlsen is in the midst of a match with the current champion, who has been the top player for years.
Right. And this guy, this young guy, it's kind of like boxing in that he's been waiting a long time to get that title shot. Everyone basically agrees that he's better than the current world chess champion, Vishwanathan Anand.
Better by quite a margin. And whereas you would expect some of the old-timers might have been a little bit jealous, a little bit of envy, instead you ended up hearing guys like Kasparov and others saying, actually, I hope he does really well and puts chess back into the larger mainstream conversation.
Nice. And Ozzy's been running this week a series of interviews with former President Bill Clinton. Got some attention for some comments he made about the Affordable Care Act.
Very much so. We had a good conversation with President Clinton last weekend here in California, and he reminded us that when President George W. Bush rolled out the Medicare Part D plan, that there also were a number of hiccups.
This happened once before. It happened when President Bush put in the Medicare drug program for seniors, which was not as complicated, but had exactly the same problem with the rollout. It was a disaster. There were people who even lost their prescriptions for their existing medicine, and they fixed it.
So that was his way of offering context to the current troubles with the healthcare.gov.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. You can explore all of the stories we talked about at npr.org/newandnext. Carlos, thanks again.
Arun, always good to be with you.
Once again, thanks for listening. This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. And about a year and a half ago, concert pianist Jeremy Denk wrote a surprising essay for our NPR Music website. It was called Why I Hate the Goldberg Variations.
The best reason to hate Bach's Goldberg Variations, aside from the obvious reason that everyone asks you all the time which of the two Glenn Gould recordings you prefer, is that everybody loves them. Not a moment goes by when someone doesn't release a new recording, accompanied by a breathless press. They're like a trendy bar that infuriatingly keeps staying trendy. Yes, I'm suspicious of the Goldbergs' popularity. Classical music isn't really supposed to be that popular. I worried for years that I would be seduced into playing them, and would become like all the others, besotted, cultish, and that is exactly what happened. I have been assimilated into the Goldberg Borg.
That's the sound of assimilation. You're listening to Jeremy Denk's new recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations, and as he predicted, critics love it. Jeremy Denk is in our New York studios. Jeremy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So the title of the essay was Why I Hate the Goldberg Variations. Obviously, there was, that was tongue-in-cheek. You don't really hate them as such. But do you have conflicting feelings about the Goldbergs?
I mean, it's one of the great masterpieces and one of the great icons of our keyboard repertoire. It does have, it has built-in, you know, problems. It's 80 minutes of G major, which is mostly G major. And I wrote in one of the other essays, I think, that it's a fool's errand attempted by the greatest genius of all time. And that's sort of true about the piece.
Well, what's funny is that, used to music essays that tell us why we should love something. And it's interesting. You have very compelling reasons why we should hate the Goldbergs. And well, let's start off with the 80 minutes of one key. Why isn't it utterly boring?
Well, the piece is kind of about invention and imagination and the joy of reinvention and reimagination. And how much can you wring out of this eight-note bass idea? In another way, it's like the biggest jazz riff ever written. It's endlessly funny in some ways and endlessly moving in other ways. And it's partly an encyclopedia in which every possibility of musical style of the time is explored. And it's partly like an adventure or a journey.
You mentioned jazz, and it's something that still amazes me after, I've listened to this piece of music a lot over the years, but it with all the architecture and the technical issues that you talk about, it sounds free and almost improvisational at times.
Yeah, there is blue notes in Bach, too. There's tremendous numbers of naughty notes, even especially in the most beautiful variations, like in number 13, mm-hmm. at the end of the most serene arcing melody, these sort of one or two naughty notes that creep in, and it's sort of bittersweet and sort of wicked, and that's one of my favorite things about Bach, is these sort of wicked last thoughts.
There's this kind of silly stereotype of Bach as being, especially brainy, and writing these multi-part, all this fugal material. And I like how you really embrace the humor. I think you use the phrase, there's a cartoon silliness about some of this. Where are you hearing that?
Well, there's a variation, I always forget the numbers, actually, but 23, I believe, is the one with the two hands chasing each other in scales going down the keyboard, and so the left hand begins and the right hand follows one eighth note later. And this joke, Bach takes it to an incredible and ridiculous extreme, so that it's sort of the Roadrunner and Coyote after each other for 2 minutes up and down the keyboard. Many's the time I have on stage rued those various acrobatics. And there's all these places, where the hands come at each other and then they have to kind of sneak over each other. And those are always very treacherous, especially in performance. And then the hands kind of cross back around and come back as if revisiting the site of an accident. I have it obviously was written for two keyboards, so there's a lot of problems that are specifically about the one keyboard piano.
So Bach back in the day was set up like a keyboardist in one of those 70s supergroups he had. You have this great line about the Goldbergs that describing it as a vast desert of happiness with occasional oases of sadness. Those are the three minor key variations. When you hear the first one, I think it's variation 15, it's all of a sudden like you're on another planet. What's that doing to you emotionally when you're feeling that, playing that?
Well, what's so beautiful is that the two hands are mirrored around an invisible center, in a sense. There's like an axis holding them and governing their motions. And sometimes they wander far from the center, and then they come crawling back to the center and always kind of echoing each other's ideas. And there's a really profound way in which those canons become like little essays in time, because you have an idea that's said, and then when you hear it the second time, it's as if the first idea is put in the past tense.
Why do you think people love this piece so much?
Well, there's so many, so many reasons. I mean, the theme itself is just one of those miracles. One of the miracles of this piece, and one of the characteristics of the theme that I find most affecting, is the way that in the last sort of quatrain of it, it does something that has not happened in the theme before, and it begins to move and sort of elide over the bars in a way that it never had before, and the melody takes off in this sort of beautiful flurry of 16th notes, and only at that moment, you know, at the end, the 16th notes reach the most beautiful place, the theme is over. And there's something about that particular, the confluence of the attainment and the relinquishing of the idea at the same time. Something about that. I think people really get moved by it, and it's something very true to life also.
Jeremy Denk, he has a new recording of the Goldberg Variations. It comes along with a fascinating DVD. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
For the week ending November 17th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, and Daniel Hajek. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi, the technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leah Delagula and Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.